This is the Kinky Cast. This is an adult, sexually explicit podcast. If you are under 18 years old, please stop the podcast now. This is episode 64 of our weekly exploration in the kinky world of BDSM and alternative relationships. Views expressed are not representative of the management of the Kinky Cast. In today's episode, we have the triumphant return of Riven Caldara and Joshua Timpani. Here's your host, Woody.
Thanks, Max, and welcome to another edition of the Kinky Cast. Sitting in the studio with me today is lovely Chrissy. How you doing today?
Hi, Woody. I'm doing great. Thanks.
I see you have some special guests in the studio.
I do. I'm so delighted today. We have managed to get some time with Riven Caldara and Joshua Timpani.
This is their triumphant return to the Kinky Cast.
That's true. They did an episode for us last year. The topic was service.
Yes.
That was fun.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
So you've traveled a long ways to be in our studio today.
Yeah, this is part of our southern tour. We just are doing a 2.5 week presentation tour. We've done Dallas, Austin, Baton Rouge. We just came from there, and now Nashville and Atlanta in a couple of days, and we're ending with Love and Leadership Conference. So this is quite a tour, and we are happy to be here because it's freezing up where we are, and it's nice and warm down here.
That is a change for us right now. It has been nice and cold down here. You were quite a hit at South Plains, I understand.
Okay. If you say so, we bolted out of South Plains to get to Austin and present, and we hardly got to hear much at all, but we tried our best. We were on all weekend and worked really hard, and we presented on disability, among other things.
We were competing for the title.
International Master Slave. We were the 2014 Northeast Master Slave title holders, and we competed for the international title, and we lost. We didn't quite make it.
The competition was fierce, though. It was fierce.
It was very stiff.
And yes.
They're all wonderful people. And we got to be locked in a room with them, or in a little corralled area with them for hours and hours. And so we got to know each other really well.
And apparently there was less than a point difference in the scoring. So
close. Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry you didn't win. You're certainly worthy of a title there, but maybe next year?
You can only run for that one once. So
really? It's limited. Yeah. I didn't know that.
One shot. That's okay. You know.
That's okay. You're here in Nashville. You're visiting us, and you're visiting MAST Nashville today.
Yes. Yay.
Riven, you're a prolific author.
I try.
How many books do you have so far?
39, but they're on many, many different genres. I would say, my current one for books on kink and alternative relationships, my number is, I'm up to 14.
And some of those are ones that you've written yourself, some of the ones that Riven and I have written together, and many of them are anthologies. We really love putting together anthologies where we get to interview people and collect writings from different people who would never put a book out on their own. But like this podcast, I assume, it's a way for people who would not otherwise get their voice out there to the public and getting their voice out.
Yes, you're right about that. Joshua, I know that several folks that I'm friends with have stories, essays, and clips of their life in the books that you've compiled. Mm-hmm. One of them is Master Ron Kay, and also Gypsy Feathers. She's got an essay in about MS that was a powerful essay she wrote. It really resonated with me. But then essays that you choose are very, very wonderful. So
we really love doing interview-based books because we get to listen. We get to sit there and listen to people to hear about their perspectives on things and then get them out there. And so it's both a service to the community, and it educates us and broadens our horizons.
We're in the same business. We're doing the audio. You're doing the printed word.
Yep.
I like it.
It's great. It's a wonderful service.
Earlier, you had mentioned disabilities.
Yeah.
You have done a book on disabilities?
We've actually done a 4-book series on master-slave relationships and disabilities, or dominant-submissive power exchange relationships. The first one that we did was, it's called Hell on Wheels, Disabled Dominance, and it's about dominance with physical disabilities. And it came about because there was a thread on a particular power exchange group on FetLife. There's a lot of those groups and a lot of threads. And this one was, would you serve a master who had disability X? And half the people on there said no. They said that, oh, no, I'd need a master. I could not serve a master who couldn't wrestle me to the ground and wasn't big and strong and tough like porn. And and I said,
Yeah, that does limit it, doesn't it?
Yeah. And so that I put that one out about physically disabled dominance. And of course, then I had to put one out on physically disabled submissives, which is called Kneeling in Spirit. And then I put out two more because I was requested to, called Broken Toys and Mastering Mind, which are for submissives and dominants, or slaves and masters, whichever sort of power exchange you like, who have mental illnesses or neurological dysfunctions or basically various head problems. So it's a four-book series, and we are very, very proud of it because no one is talking about this. There's a little bit out. Bob Rubel put out an anthology once about BDSM and disabilities, but no one's really talking about alternative relationships and how to cope with disability. And the porn is all full of, you know, the masters and slaves are always perfect and they're all strong and tall and never have bad knees or chronic illness or anything like that. And in real life, people come with all kinds of flaws, and we get old and we get hit by buses and things happen to us, and we need to know how to cope and how to keep the flavor of our relationship, how to keep our particular lifestyle as well as possible while dealing with an imperfect body.
What's amazing about that is a lot of the older DOMs that may be in the physical limitation area have a tremendous amount of experience and a mental aptitude that you won't touch in a younger person.
Oh, certainly. I know for myself that I can be dominant from a hospital bed. I don't need to be physically strong and on my feet. I know what to do. And just from the BDSM aspect, you know, you can top from a wheelchair. I can tell you that. That's possible, too. And some people have issues about that. Some people really feel that if they don't look like the porn or their partner doesn't look like the porn, that this isn't going to work. So we put out these books to change people's minds on that.
Can you give me an example of how to work around certain limitations, pick a limitation?
With regard to relationships or with regard to play?
Let's take play.
Let's see, I talked about topping from a wheelchair. That can be lots of fun if you have an assistant to sort of pull you around in the wheelchair from behind, because you can handcuff someone to those arm bars on the wheelchair, and then they sort of have to crawl after you, and they're right there, and they can't do anything, and you can do anything you want to them, and the wheelchair can be a really nice place to hang all your toys.
Convenient.
Yes. And
Lots of hard points on a wheelchair.
Oh, yes.
Sure. Lots of hard points, and which, if you've got an S-type in a chair, those are hard points for some bondage. I have photos from a dominant who sent me a picture of him and his walker, with his walker being used as his workspace with all the toys hanging off of them.
Oh, it brings new meaning to toy bag.
Yes. Wow. Yeah. And when you have issues with your hands or something like that, and you're having trouble holding or wielding, that's a matter of altering your toys. Looking at your toys and saying, what can I do? I've got lupus, which is a chronic illness, and I have some days I have a lot of fatigue, some days I have a lot of pain from rheumatoid arthritis, and sometimes I can't hold big heavy things, sometimes I can't wave a whip. So on difficult days, I'll tell the boys, all right, I need you to be helpful victims, not helpless victims, but helpful victims, and get into positions where I can get to you, and find me really lightweight implements that are going to hurt a lot.
His other boy and I really have done a lot of experimentation to find ways that we can make it easy on him if he's not in great physical shape. I mean, he's certainly got no interest in tying either of us up, so that he's like, I've got boys for that, right? So he'll say, I want one of you to tie the other one up. I don't care which one, but get them in some position where I can fuck them later. And when I'm done with the one, we can swap off, so don't worry. And that's a lot of fun for us. I mean, we both really like the sort of sexual objectification of that it's not him putting a huge amount of effort into us having a fantastic experience. It's us sort of being there as tools for his pleasure.
It also takes little physical effort to do a mind fuck.
Yes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you can stay psychologically ahead of someone, if you can play with fear or humiliation or whatever it is that trips their triggers.
Now you're speaking my language.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
and that's why it's so important, I think. Even for play, I think it's really important to get to know each other well enough and for for both people to be really open about what their what gets in deep, what really touches you deep, what really makes you go, ooh, yeah. And triggering that again and again. You don't need toys to do that.
I found for myself, I've often said to Raven that I like men with scars. And I mean that literally from just a kink perspective. But also, I like seeing someone who has clearly been through a lot and has not let it get them down, who has faced things that other people would let stop them and has not been stopped. I remember some years ago, I was in Philly on the subway and I saw this good looking guy and I'm checking him out. And then I realized he's in a wheelchair, right? And I'm like, okay, well, you know, that's interesting. And it was a wheelchair without any handles on it because there's no one pushing this guy around. And I see him wheel himself over to the escalator. And I'm like, where is he going on the escalator, right? And he just sort of does a little quarter turn with the chair and hops himself onto that escalator with one brawny arm grabbing onto the railing and rides the escalator up in his wheelchair. And I'm like, there is a dude who does not let anyone tell him what he can and cannot do. I like that. I like that a lot.
And he's in great physical shape. That's a lot of physical work to do that.
It is.
And so you could translate that into a pretty good scene.
Yes, definitely.
My second boy, Brandon, who's not down here with us, he has a fibro. And he came to me years ago and said, I want to be in service, but I don't think anyone would want me because I've got fibro and he's also got some neurological problems and he has bad days where he is down and can't do anything. And I said, what, managing a chronic illness in a service position? I can do that. This is no problem. I manage my own life. I can do this for you. And one of the things that he discovered was that endorphins help his fibro. So he actually has a very high pain tolerance, and he can be a really badass bottom. And he can get up there and get hit with the electric strap in his junk and he falls down, and which is fun because I like to see that. And then he gets back up and says, okay, hit me again. And
this was psychologically very good for him too, because I mean, he grew up being disabled. He grew up being the crippled kid who could never do anything, who could never keep up with the other kids, right? And then so for him to be able to play, I mean, in private as well, but especially in public, to be able to play in ways that people look at him and are like, damn, what a badass. He's like, I've never been a badass in my life. This is really awesome.
And he's being supported by people that love him and care about him tremendously. Yes. And how wonderful is that?
Yes.
And I really wanted a heavy masochist, and so it's interesting that I got someone who is a heavy masochist because of their disability.
When you're looking at different types of play, often we do eroticize helplessness. We eroticize having physical control over someone. So when the bottom has some type of physical disability that makes them a little more helpless, in some ways, I mean, some people that we've talked to have really found ways they can eroticize that they enjoy the fact that this person is helpless.
And there's often ways, just in terms of the ordinary life, being disabled can really get you down. It can really feel like a great weight on you, dragging you down. And having kinky partners who will help you find fun ways throughout your day to put a little bit of eroticism and joy and desire into this. Just as a little example, I've got liver diabetes and I have to take my blood sugar regularly. And I hate being stabbed with needles. I really hate it. So I have the boys do it for me, which is slightly better, but not much. Josh, I'm like day two of doing this, noticed how much I just liked it. And he said, sir, would it be more fun for you is if after we, you know, got your blood sugar checked, you took the diabetic lancet and got to stab me? We now have a protocol in place where that whichever boy does the stabbing of me then gets stabbed. And diabetic lancets, if you ever see them, they have a tiny little quarter-inch needle, so you can just really go at someone's arm with that. And that makes it so much more fun for me and something I can look forward to.
Turnabout becomes fair play at that point.
Yeah, yes. So us being kinksters, that really makes a difference.
I have friends that are vanilla with disabilities like fibro and that sort of thing. And they don't have anybody that really shares in what they have because if they have able-bodied friends, they're just the drag on them. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the kink world, you know, if we understand what a limitation is, and that's what negotiation's all about, is find out where your strengths and weaknesses are and work within them.
Yes.
Some of the books that you've written, I'm looking at Broken Toys. What does Broken Toys pertain to?
The book Broken Toys is submissives and slaves with mental illness or neurological dysfunction. And that started out as a website with tips for dominants and masters in how to deal with someone. We got essays from people who were talking about play in terms of how do you negotiate play with someone who's got emotional, who's got like PTSD or emotional triggers. And you bottom with the or tops even, but in this case, bottoms with the PTSD or emotional triggers or some kind of mental illness issue that might be set off. How do you talk about that in negotiation? What do you say? And it's very important to have this kind of communication. And also in relationships, how do you have a power dynamic with someone who's got this going on? And at what point do you know when it's above your pay grade? When it's not something that you can handle and you need to back off and say, it looks like crazy is mastering you, and this is not something that I have the skill to deal with, and that needs to be a no-blame situation that, you know, I do have the skill for that. And there are people who would come to me who might come to me for either for play or for a relationship, and they've got various problems, and I would say, oh, okay, I can work with that. I can read up on that. I can learn about that. You can tell me about that, and we can find a way. And there's some issues where I'd be like, you know, I think you're a wonderful person, but I think that that is above my ability. I worry that it's just above my pay grade. So making those decisions, making the decisions of how much authority should you take over someone's medical care in a power exchange relationship, that's a very, very personal decision between two people, and it's going to vary. How do you negotiate for play? How do you negotiate emotional triggers? We also put mastering mind together because that's an issue on the other side too. I've got PTSD. So does my second boy, Brandon, and Josh has Asperger's, which is its own interesting situation in terms of sensory issues and dealing with BDSM. We have to be very careful of his sensory issues. So these are all delicate things that no one is talking about. If you bring them up on most public forums, people say, well, just don't do it. If you've got any of these problems, just, you know, stay home.
And that cuts the play field literally in half or worse. Mm-hmm. Practically mm-hmm. every submissive I've ever had has either had a form of autism, Asperger's, some type of emotional issue mm-hmm. that had to be dealt with. And it is like walking a minefield.
It is.
And so one of the big issues here is when deciding that it's above your pay grade is a little tough.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because you're starting negotiation with somebody you don't know. You don't know where the traps are. You don't know where the landmines are.
Yeah.
And you're walking through it very carefully. You do a first play. You find out if there's any triggers, if there's anything that's uncomfortable. You do a lot of questioning
yep.
along the way. And it becomes a journey. And you can have a wonderful partner mm-hmm. that way.
Yep, you certainly yes. can.
I'm very ADD, and I'm dyslexic in many ways. And so I have to interpolate a lot of things mm-hmm. that have to become meaningful so yep. that people understand how I'm playing.
Yep.
Yeah.
I wanted to say that you mentioned that during negotiations, these personal quirks should be brought up, whatever it happens
Absolutely.
To be.
Absolutely.
And a lot of people don't, and they won't, because they, as you mentioned, the feedback you were reading about folks saying, well, then just stay home. Well, people, they don't want to stay home. So what they're going to do is they're going to zip their lips and not tell anybody. Not
so. And
then it's going to blow up even worse, because that's what I think is happening more than anything. You get out there and all of a sudden something goes sideways and you don't know why, because the person never told you that they've suffered from depression for 15 years.
Yeah.
Yes.
And there's a lot of that, I think. First, there's this sense that, oh, we can't talk about how anyone in the scene might have mental or emotional issues, because there's already this social stigma that, well, if the only reason that you want to do these perverted things is because you're mentally ill.
Which is not right? true.
So there's this sense of like, well, we need to not make the community look bad by being open about the fact that some of us do experience issues in that way.
We're a segment of the population, of the entire population, and I think every group is represented in our community
yep.
as in any community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
What I want to see, and there's a certain amount of, well, if I'm honest, I will be rejected. And to me, the what needs to happen is first enough education so that there are people who will not reject you, because they'll know what to do, or they'll be willing to, they'll have resources to be able to find that out. And secondly, a lot more confidence to be able to say, no, this is what I've got. And if it's not something that you can handle, that's okay. There are other people in the world. Because we do that with our fetishes.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm not into that. I'm not into, say, you know, I don't know, pick a fetish. And you are, and you're really looking for that. No harm, no foul. There are other people in the world. And yeah. so that same sort of deal. And
there's the sense of being accepted for who you are, right? If you're being accepted for something that you're only pretending to be, if you're being accepted for this image that you're putting out there that doesn't really represent you, that doesn't... that doesn't work out long run.
No, it doesn't work out. What we do is real. It's real. The layers of bullshit gets peeled away quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you can't hide.
I wouldn't say that necessarily that everyone who's involved in kink is, let's say, more psychologically evolved than people who are not. But I will say that you can make a vanilla relationship limp along with a huge amount of dishonesty that just when you start adding in power exchange, you start adding in the type of strong emotions that
or polyamory,
you start bringing these things in, and that same level of emotional dishonesty will just make things explode. Mm-hmm. You can't, it's not sustainable.
Secrets don't work. Mm-hmm. If you're not honest, it's not going to work.
Yeah. There's also that when you've got a situation where the bottom's got some emotional issues or even physical issues that we were saying earlier, there's sort of like a minefield for the dominant to navigate. I think there has to be an acknowledgement that the dominant is not omnipotent.
Yeah.
Right? That if you're going to go in and saying, well,
that's blasphemy, you know.
Yeah.
If I get this exactly right, I'm going to get all the information from you and then we will know 100% guarantee that I will not flip your shit out. Oh, you can't know, right? You can't know. You can do everything you can to make it more likely that things will go well. But you got to go into it saying, well, I'm going to make my good faith effort to keep you emotionally safe, to keep you physically safe. But realize that we're playing in a risky area here. So are you willing, as the bottom, to accept the level of risk that this has entailed? Are you willing to trust me that I'm doing my best, even if it turns out that things don't go as well as we hoped?
And also, can I add that I think that as the bottoms need to do their work and not rely on their top to be their therapist or their doctor or their counselor.
Or to be omnipotent.
Or to be... No, wait. I say, oh God, quite a bit.
I think in general, there needs to be an ethic of responsibility with regard to people's disabilities, honesty and responsibility. And I'm saying this as someone who is disabled. Even coming into a play space, it's my job to take care of myself. It's my job to figure out what is going to mess with me. And if I can avoid it. It's so much better if I can go to an organizer of a play space or if I can go to a potential partner and say, okay, this is my issues. This here is not going to work for me. This here is going to be a problem. And here are some suggestions. Here's a list of useful suggestions that we could do to make the situation better and sort of make it easy for them in that sense. So I need to advocate for myself. And I think regardless of how it goes, whether you're negotiating a scene, whether you're negotiating a relationship, you need to advocate for yourself, and honesty is part of that and responsibility is part of that. It always goes better when you bring solutions to the table.
We'll be right back after this word from our friends at Self.
I'm coming for the rope.
You know, I'm going for the electricity.
I've heard they've even got classes for introverts.
It's Southeast Leather Fest. You never know what's going to happen.
Visit SELeatherFest.com. Come to South June 11th through the 14th in Atlanta and direct your vision.
We're back with Raven Caldera and Joshua.
Hi.
Hi. Hello. Again. You have some books on relationships.
Yes,
lots of them.
Give us some high points on what you talk about in relationships.
So we love talking to people about the specific tools you can use to make these relationships work. I think there's this huge sense in the community that if you were a real dominant, if you were a real master, a real slave, you would just know. You would just be able to do these things. And I actually have talked to a few people who are like that. They just know. It just rolls off of them.
They're the minority, though.
There's a lot of people who need to work on specific skills, who need to do things that are different than what's described in the porn. I mean, we don't, in our romantic vanilla relationships, think, oh, I'll just do it just like the porn shows us how to do it. They're such a wonderful model. But we tend to look at things like Story of O. God bless her, Laura Antinou, right? We tend to look at that and say, oh, that's how these relationships are supposed to go. No, that's porn. That's porn. We write things that are not porn. We write things that are practical skills for making real-world relationships work.
Okay, porn. Let's see. 50 Shades of what is it?
Don't even go there.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a huge fan of porn, but you can't look at porn and say that's the tools I need to make a relationship work.
No, you're right. You can't. They're great. It's hot reading material. It's great masturbation, fun time stuff, but not for everyday life. And you have a book, Building the Team.
Yes.
And I have, I don't know, 7 of your books. I was reading that last year and found it to be really helpful, navigating problems and working through problems.
Yeah.
And what we do is so intimate and personal. And mm-hmm. when you're in a power exchange or an authority exchange and you have that energy exchange, and I'm a slave, I come from the bottom side, and I need that exchange yeah. and I feed off that, and I try to make it a loop. So it's a healthy cycle. Mm-hmm. Out of balance is never good.
Part of why we love to teach on troubleshooting, like power dynamic relationships and polyamory and that sort of thing, is because we've made so many mistakes.
Yes.
We are not those folks who just sort of get it right straight off and never have any. Yeah, that's not us. That's not us. We've been together for 13 years. Yeah, 13 years of this. And the first...
I wouldn't say we've made every mistake you could possibly make.
No, not every, but oh boy, do we have a record.
We've made a lot of mistakes. We've made a lot. We've gone in directions that didn't work for us. We've gone in directions that have worked for other people, but for us they didn't work. And we've had to say, oh, okay, what?
Throw that out the window.
This is not going to work for us.
But one thing I've noticed is that you said 13 years and you're still struggling along and plugging along and making an effort. And it's communication. You're working it through.
It takes continual effort. Although, I mean, I got to say, now things are so much smoother than they were in the beginning. I mean, things work so well. It took us probably the first 5 years were pretty rocky in a lot of different ways.
At
this point, things are much smoother, but it's not that we don't ever have problems. It's not that we don't ever run into situations where we say, oh, geez, this isn't working at all. We got to do something differently here.
Mm-hmm. It's just that now, after 13 years, we have so many tools
mm-hmm.
that when a problem arises, we can quickly run down a list of tools and find something to solve it. But those took years to work out. And part of why we do, like we wrote the Building the Team book, and we write about, we teach about teamwork relationships as opposed to adversarial relationships, because the adversarial stuff really doesn't work for everybody, and the
it's really hot. I mean, the porn that has that model of, like, you know, of a very aggressive stance from the dominant, a very based on punishment, right?
I will beat you until you do it right.
And I mean, I think
doesn't work for everybody.
Fantasy is where the dominant is sort of like belligerent and a little mentally unstable and aggressive. That can be really hot stuff, but it's not necessarily going to work full time.
No,
right? You can't have that full time.
No, it sure won't work for me. I'll be a broken pile. I can't deal with it. It's not my game. Sorry.
Yeah.
Another book that we're very proud of that we put out was it's a collection of essays co-edited by myself and a friend who's a psychiatrist, and it's called Unequal by Design: Counseling Power Dynamic Relationships. And it is the book by mental health professionals for mental health professionals that everyone should take to their therapist if they are in this kind of relationship. And we put it together as a way of educating more kink aware professionals. Because often, just because someone says they're a kink aware professional doesn't mean that they know what to do with this. It means that they're not freaked out by it, but they don't necessarily know how to effectively counsel folks when they come with these kinds of relationships.
Well, they don't have the training.
Yeah.
No.
The school isn't going to give you that.
Yep, yeah. Exactly. And I think we in the community, we have to do that educating, and we have to reach those people and have more places where folks can go for counseling that's actually effective.
So one of the things that we do, I mean, first off, we speak from our own experience of problems that we've
absolutely
faced. But also we have a lot of people in our local community who come to us and say, oh, help, help, my power exchange relationship is going terribly wrong, and I don't know what to do, and you guys seem to have your shit together, so why don't you help us out? You know, let's talk about what's going on.
And the first thing we ask is, how long have you been together? And more often than not, what's the answer?
2 years.
2 years.
Right about 2 years.
With a power exchange relationship, we don't know why it is, but a large majority of people at the 2-year mark, there's a meltdown.
I know why.
Why?
The NRE's gone.
There is that.
There
and
is
I
that.
Think that there's a lot of things where we are very interested in the role that we've established for ourselves, and we've really thrown ourselves into this role and ignored a lot of the parts of ourselves that don't exactly fit that role. And after about 2 years, all those other parts of ourselves that we haven't integrated into this role start being like, hey, 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 I'm not going away, right? You
right.
need to find a way to sort of break down that role that you've been living in and incorporate your whole self into that. And that is not a clean and easy process. That can be a very emotional, tumultuous, difficult process.
So we often tell people who come to us around the 2-year mark, this is normal. This is what happens. At 2 years, we had to stop and throw out a whole lot of stuff and totally restructure all over again. This is the way things work. You can get through it. It is survivable. So, and it's interesting to see that. It's very statistically interesting.
Yeah, that is. 2 years.
Yep. 2-year mark. We're going to do a workshop, I think, that'll be called 2 Years In.
I think that's a real valuable asset for people to understand. Mm-hmm. How to get beyond 24 months.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think also that there's a phenomenon that no one is talking about that needs to be talked about called, which we call falling in love with the dynamic. And this happens when you have folks who have, they've wanted this thing for so long, whether it's a power exchange relationship, especially a power exchange, but often just a relationship where they can get BDSM, and they have fantasized and masturbated for years and years and years, and then they get it. They have someone to do this with. It doesn't matter if the person is the right person for them or not. They're so in love with the dynamic. They're so in love with this kind of relationship and this kind of lifestyle that it takes them a year or so to realize that really they're in love with the dynamic more than they're in love with this person.
If they have that realization at all.
Well, eventually they will, because it'll fall apart.
Right. Right.
That does not last. Yeah. Sooner or later, it will come crashing down. They settled for the first thing that came along that would give them this dynamic without realizing that you need to be a lot pickier. A lot pickier. It's like the more alternative your relationship is, the less easy it is to paper over differences, and the more initial fit you need to have.
A very good fit. Now, I found that even when it falls apart, there isn't always, like you say, that realization, that self-awareness of what's going on. Often what we see is people, when they get to that stage of things falling apart because it wasn't a good fit, is that they say, oh, well, so-and-so just was a bad master.
Bad slave, not a real slave.
You know,
usually
Candy
Andy
was not
life.
A real slave. That's why the relationship fell apart. No, not because you and Candy were looking for different things, but because Candy's the worst slave ever, not a real slave. Oh, okay, that's the realization you came to. That's not a psychologically productive realization.
I've been told that I'm a bad submissive and a bad slave. And I said, no.
And a bad little girl, too.
And a bad little girl. And I said, well, I'm really not. I'm just not the right fit for you.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. And it needs to be a good fit.
Yeah.
But there's also a thing called track record. And when you look at a submissive that goes from one top to another.
Mm-hmm. Or vice versa.
You can take it either way. At that point, you have to look at what is the common element
of
the failure.
Exactly. And some people really aren't suited. They have an emotional attraction to a role that they're in the end not really suited for. And in some cases, they have, how do I put it? The thing that would work for them is so small, right? That they would really thrive in one specific circumstance that's unlikely to be the circumstance that's being offered.
One of my best-selling books, actually, is called Power Circuits, Polyamory in a Power Dynamic.
That's often a deal-breaker for people, polyamory.
And I have that book. It's fabulous.
There are books on poly, and there's a thriving polyamorous community. Most people in that community are kind of iffy about power exchange because...
kind of iffy is an understatement.
Yeah, there's a lot of radical egalitarianism there. And on the other side of this, there are folks who are trying to do DSM-MS, and they're trying to do poly. They sort of try to throw poly on top of it without knowing anything about it, and they litter the forums of FetLife too every week, breaking up. And it sort of goes both ways. On the one hand, the MS folks need to learn that there are specific lessons, basic things that the poly folk have already learned that apply. They absolutely apply, and you cannot ignore those lessons, and you need to learn them. And at the same time, there are some things, there's like a small subset of relationship rules that don't work, that are built for egalitarian relationships and don't work for power exchange. And being able to bridge those two has been really hard for a lot of people because there's nothing out there talking about that.
There's also that there's a lot of people who in the kink scene, who in the leather community, who are doing multiple person relationships, but for some reason really object to the term polyamory. That's not a term that they resonate with, and that's not a community that they're ever going to go to look for help and support and information. So that really prevents them from getting that.
In all fairness, polyamory is a specific form of poly.
Yes, that can be the case.
Well, actually, the definition of polyamory varies widely.
Yes.
Depending on what demographic you're talking to, what area of the country, what class levels. You can pick people randomly off the internet and ask them what polyamory means, and you will get many, many different definitions. There's no one defined definition that even the majority of people are interested in agreeing on.
We can go back to the Latin and Greek, and I do say that for a reason.
Yeah.
because it is
should be multi-amory
or
polyphilia.
Polyphilia, that's right.
And so, if that were the definition, you know, mm-hmm. it is one that shares a heart with many.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In many of the BDSM cases that we see out here, it's polyamory is just multiple people. Period.
Mm-hmm. But multiple people doing what?
Anything they want, it seems.
Yes. But an example of one of the cultural differences between folks over who do a lot of power exchange or in leather or something like that, and egalitarian folks is the egalitarian folks. There's got to be sex going on, or doesn't? It's not polyamory. It's you're just good friends and you care about each other. And in fact, people have said that's creepy. The idea, I mean, just because you love me, I'm not your lover. Don't call me polyamorous with you. Whereas you go over here, you've got leather families where you have non-sexual service relationships, mm-hmm. and these people they consider them their partners.
Right.
They consider them to be polyamorous partners, and these are sort of places where we look at each other across this cultural barrier and say, what? And my second boy was he was part of my family 6 months in. I didn't play with him till 9 months in. I didn't have sex with him till 10 months in. It was strictly service. And a part of that is, I think, because one of the differences is folks who are egalitarian do not understand how service can be an amazingly intimate relationship, even if nobody ever takes their pants off.
I'm shaking
even
my
if they,
head.
They never touch it. Nobody touches anything except maybe your boot or your hand. There's nothing that could be construed as physically erotic touching, and yet this can be a hugely emotionally intimate relationship in its own way.
That's the huge landmine that whenever we talk about poly, that I always want to bring up, is that so often we see people either getting involved in play relationships or in service type relationships who are in a monogamous relationship, and they're saying, then the other partner is saying, oh, well, I would totally flip out if you got romantically or sexually involved with someone, but since you're not having sex with this person, fine. That'll be okay.
I don't want to do this thing with you. I'm not into you, into it. You can go and find someone who's into it, but no sex. And they're like, okay, fine, no sex. And then months down the road, you know, nobody's pants have come off. Everybody is still being good. And they see a glance exchanged because
The other partner.
Yeah, between their partner and the other partner. And suddenly it's like, oh my God, this looks like emotional infidelity. And none of them expected that in a relationship that would have no sex as it's culturally understood, that there would have this huge intense bond, which often doesn't look or feel like standard romance mm-hmm. at all, but it can be incredibly deep. And then they're like, whoa, wait a minute. I didn't expect that to happen.
They think that's going to make it emotionally safe for them. And
it's
really,
not.
It doesn't.
Well, it's drawing a boundary that is not defendable at all. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's out of ignorance because nobody's talking about how intimate these things can be without sex and in many cases without a lot of even touch.
I have intense relationships with friends mm-hmm. for 40 plus years.
Yeah.
To say that I love them is very true.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
They are not sexual partners with me in any form. I talk to them daily mm-hmm. on the phone. They're geographically distant from me, but the fact is we have a closeness that we have had for decades.
Yeah.
And right now, if my partner was jealous of that relationship, then there'd be a problem because that is a legacy relationship to me that is valuable, and I really need that emotional connection mm-hmm. in my life.
Yeah.
I always say people come into relationships with baggage.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I have had a lot of people that I'm attached to along the way. As I come into a relationship, a newer relationship, if they don't understand what I'm bringing in, mm-hmm. then we are going to have a problem over that in the future when something goes wrong.
Yeah.
So getting all that up on the table. And I know so many people that get into a new relationship and demands are made that they uncouple their baggage. That never works well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would be nice if we could do that. I think if we could have done that already, we would have done it.
One of the things that I think that folks in the kink scene can bring to the larger community is that we have a much more expansive concept of what – a sexual connection can entail, of what an intimate, an emotionally intimate connection can entail, rather than this, you've got this sort of one model of this is how you do a romantic relationship and that's the context in which you have sex. Even that sort of dichotomy that some that I see very, I was involved in the swinger scene for a while. You see this people trying to draw a really clear line between this is someone who I'm romantically involved with and this is people who I'm just fucking.
And also, and, what is sex?
This and what is counts sex, as sex?
This is not right? sex. And gee,
so often you'd see in the among swingers that you'd have people who were they were just fucking, right? And then they were, you know, chatting after the fucking and they started forming a friendship. And then they decide, hey, you know, we're going on vacation. Do you want to come along? And it starts building up this long-term relationship that doesn't fit the mold that they had sort of signed up for when they started.
And the next thing you know, they're kissing.
Oh my God.
And I think we definitely, I think the queer demographic helps with this too, but I think we're the kinksters, I think, are in the advance of the what is sex. How do you negotiate with partners, with multiple partners? Well, you can have this, you can have sex with these, but not those. Well, what sex?
It's Clinton rules.
Yeah. Well, that doesn't work for me.
And
certainly.
Sometimes it's like, well, it feels like sex when I'm doing it.
Yeah.
You know?
And maybe it doesn't when you're doing it. And how do we, where do we draw those lines? If nobody's pants came off, if no orify were touched by anything, is it still sex? Well, mm-hmm. I've done some stuff that fell into those boundaries, and it was sex. Yeah.
I could reach out and touch somebody's hand mm-hmm. and have sex with them.
Yeah.
And I've had situations where, you know, someone could kneel at my feet in a certain way and give me something, and there is a sexual energy that goes on.
The first time I had a submissive kneel in front of me, I mean, just the flush that ran through my body mm-hmm. of intense emotional.
Yes.
It was like, oh my God, what is this?
And we don't have the language yet. We're still working on putting together the language to describe that kind of connection, which is not like the standard sex and romance of vanilla stuff.
It was overwhelming, and I really didn't know how to deal with it.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. Exactly.
It's awesome.
And also, there's this idea in a lot of the kink scene that the bottoms are in an emotionally vulnerable position, but no acknowledgement of the emotional vulnerability that the tops are in.
Good point.
That they are experiencing a lot of emotions. That they're that even in many cases, just admitting, oh, I want to do this to you, requires a huge amount of emotional vulnerability on the top. And I think that they often don't get the acknowledgement or support for that. They're expected to sort of be these brick walls.
You're right about that. I've heard that from other tops. People don't respect and understand what they bring to the table, what they're bringing, besides the toy bag.
There's a huge mm-hmm. vulnerability, whether you're a top or a dominant or a master. First of all, you had to work through enough of your own baggage and enough cultural baggage to realize, assuming that you're a thoughtful person, to realize that you wanted to do this. And some of these can be pretty unacceptable things. And you have to think about that. Well, what does
that say
about
me? Does this make me a terrible person because I want to do these things?
I want to own someone. I want to own a human being. What does that say about me? And I wrestled with that for years. I had terrible shame over that. And it's incredibly important to me and very healing not just to have someone who's willing to do the other side of these various dualities enthusiastically. Hey, pick me. Yes, I want that too. But also to see these parts of me, to see the parts of me, things I want to do that I know I can't ever do because they're not okay. But
many of us
my
have
libido,
fantasies we can't ever do.
But some fetishes are better kept private.
But that they can look at that and they can see that and not say, oh, you're a monster, but oh, no, I love that part of you too. I accept that part of you too. And we will find little ways to feed that. And it feeds me too. And that's probably, it's amazingly healing.
And it's a huge amount of emotional vulnerability for the top.
For me to open up and say, no, really, this is me. And
these are my desires, right?
These are my desires. That's hard. So I'd like to see more talk about people on the top side of the slash being able to say these things in public and to get support and not just always be expected to be brick walls for the comfort of the people on the lower side of the slash.
We're almost at the end of our time today, but what's next for you?
Ooh.
For presenting? Well, we get to go home and have a couple of weeks at home. This title year has been just wonderful, amazing, but frenetic. And we're both looking forward to getting home. And then we're going to go back out. We've got the MS Gathering in Delaware, and we've got PXS in Ohio. But overall, our what's next is finishing out this title year and then getting back to some writing, because I've not been able to do a lot of writing.
So what's the next book?
Oh, boy. I always work on two or three at a time. because that's how I combat writer's block. If I can't write on one, I go to the next one. And I'm working on one that is energy work and energy exchange for people in power dynamic relationships, called Polarities of Power.
And that sounds interesting.
We're hoping Lee Harrington will co-author that one.
Ooh, oh, yay.
Yeah, well, Lee doesn't know that he's going to get arm twisted for that.
he does now.
Wait till he hears the cast.
But yeah. I really want him to. But he was too busy. But I was like, oh, please, I'll wait. I'll hold out. And I'm also putting one together that is just going to be a little book of questions. And it's going to be how to negotiate your power dynamic relationship. And just all the questions that people... that months later they come on FetLife and they said, oh, it's falling apart because we forgot to ask about this. When we were getting together, we didn't ask about these things. Well, I want to put all those in a book so that when you do sit down and negotiate this, you can at least look at these questions and have talked about them and not be trapped 6 months later by, oh, gee, we should have talked about that before we got involved.
A book with all the possibilities. This is a very thick book.
The project that I'm actually looking forward to working on, and this might not be in the immediate future, but coming up sometime soon, we'll probably do some classes on it for a while before we put it together in a book. But that is looking at the process of emotional transformation that the submissive or slave goes through in over the course of the relationship, the process of coming to terms with slavery, of coming into yourself as a slave, because we've noticed that there are certain patterns that people fall into, like that 2-year point of having, there's this certain thing that not everyone has, but there's this pattern that we very often see. There's lots of different little patterns that we see that are part of a person's process. I want to put that together.
Sounds fascinating. My number is the 3-year mark.
Yeah.
3-year. Mm-hmm. That's when I start to question everything. Mm-hmm. And then 5-year, I start to buck.
Mm-hmm.
And I start to push all the boundaries.
Yeah.
And if I can get past that, I'm okay. I haven't been able to go longer than 6. 6 and I blow up.
pushing boundaries, not you.
Mm-hmm. I'm a brat. People tell me. I don't know. I ask questions. I'm sorry.
You ask questions. You should ask.
I do. I want to know everything. Why?
And
why not?
How else do you find out what's going on?
I know.
Raven, Joshua, we really want to thank you for coming to visit us at the studio today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
You have been listening to episode 64 of The Kinky Cast. The Kinky Cast is a production of Rooster in the Round. On behalf of Woody, the Beast, and all our kinky crew, I'm Max. See you next week when we have the Frolicon wrap-up show.